This is Fresh Air. During the Kurdish rebellion following the Gulf War, it was difficult to get information about what was happening, and reporters that managed to get into Iraq were at great risk. Today, the British Ministry of Defense confirmed that two bodies were found in northeastern Iraq by Royal Marines who were searching for three missing BBC journalists. The bodies are being flown back to England, but have not yet been identified. The first journalist believed to be killed in the war was German photographer Gad Gross, who was on assignment for Newsweek. He was covering the Kurdish rebellion with several other journalists, including my guest Frank Smythe. Smythe was on assignment for The Village Voice, The Economist, and CBS News Radio. Yesterday, Smythe told us that on March 28th, as the Iraqis were smashing the Kurdish rebellion, he, Gross, and French photographer Alan Boo ran into an Iraqi ambush. Gross hid in a nearby house with their Kurdish guide. Smythe believes they were both executed when Iraqi soldiers found them. Smythe and Boo hid in a ditch for 18 hours before they were captured. They were released 17 days later, having spent 2 weeks in an Iraqi prison. Smythe says Saddam Hussein personally made the decision to release him and Boo. Smythe had been charged with being a spy. He says Iraqi soldiers don't comprehend the role of Western journalists.
Iraqi military intelligence has no concept whatsoever of what journalists, particularly Western reporters, do. As my impression, based on what I was able to ascertain inside Iraq in prison, in Iraqi custody, as well as talking to people outside, and the response that that we got indicates that the foreign ministry and the Ministry of Information believed we were reporters and were lobbying for our release. But military intelligence seemed convinced that we were spies, and that me in particular, being an American, that I was a CIA agent. And I believe that they were asking for permission to begin torturing us to find out what it is we knew. Once, of course, they decide to torture you, then even once they, you know, if they find out they're wrong, they have to kill you, because they're not going to torture a Western reporter and then let him go. So it's quite clear that they genuinely thought I was a spy, and from their perspective, it's, you know, it certainly made sense. We were found, as it was explained to us, in Iraq, first of all, without a visa. Second of all, we had entered the country with the Kurds, which the Iraqis consider terrorists. And third, we were found not at a checkpoint, but we were found in a combat zone, in a combat situation. There were some reports, that rumors running around, that there were Western intelligence operatives with the Kurds. I never saw any. I don't know if they were there or not. But certainly I think military intelligence finally thought that, hey, we finally got one, we got this guy. You know, and they really thought that they had finally, you know, had proof of foreign intervention in the Kurdish uprising.
You were eventually taken to an Iraqi prison, and all around you, you heard people being tortured. How did you handle your interrogation? What happened during it?
Well, there were several interrogations. The first one took place in an airbase, which was relatively mild. We were not blindfolded. But then there were others where we were blindfolded, and, you know, it went on for maybe an hour, and just relentless questions. The worst interrogation occurred April 3rd, I believe, in prison. Someone came to the cell and said, okay, you come with us. I was taken out of the cell. I was blindfolded, led down a corridor, and into a room where there were, you know, I couldn't see, but there were obviously many men, you know, maybe at least six men present in the room. They then went through what had now become a very routine interrogation. How did you come into Iraq? Who did you talk to? Basically trying to get as much intelligence out of us on the location of Kurdish leaders, Kurdish representatives inside of Syria, the opposition conference in Beirut, etc. But at the end, in the beginning, they said, well, what is your real job? And I said, I'm a reporter, and then went on with the interrogation. Towards the end of the interrogation, which Alan timed, it lasted 2 hours, they said, all right, tell us now about what it is you do. And I said, I'm a reporter. I work for CBS News, and The Village Voice, and other publications. And they said, no, tell us your real job. Tell us about your relationship with the CIA. And they seemed quite convinced that I was a CIA agent. And they were adamant, and they told me Now, don't lie to us. We know we have our own proof, our own sources. If you continue to lie to us, you will stay here many years. But if you tell the truth, meaning if I confess to being a CIA agent, then you will go free. Alan and I knew that they might make that offer. We knew it was a trap, and we had decided that unless we were, you know, the pain was unbearable and there's something, nothing we could do, we would not under any circumstances make a false confession as to being spies. Barzov, I don't remember his first name, was an Iranian-born British reporter who took that offer. He confessed to being a British intelligence agent on the promise that he would go free, I believe in March 1990, just 1 year before, and he was hanged without trial.
When you were getting interrogated and they were asking you for information on the Kurds and the Kurdish leaders, did you give them that information?
We gave them pretty much things that were already published. One of the problems of military intelligence is they just didn't seem to have access to any publications. If they had read my reports in The Economist or elsewhere or on CBS Radio, it all would have been quite clear who we had talked to and how we had gotten into the country. But that information we did provide. We also were normally I would never say how I got into an area, but we had no choice but to admit that we had come through Syria because they had our passport. And our passports had an entry stamp for Syria, no exit stamp. So it was clear how we had gotten into Kurdistan.
Were you tortured in any way?
No. Physically, we were never harmed. The guards in the prison made it clear that if and when they got the green light, they were going to have a field day with us. But we were never physically abused.
When you were in the cell and you were hearing a lot of prisoners who were being tortured, you were hearing them scream, you were even able to peek out the window and watch them being tortured. What kind of mental havoc did that play with you mentally? Because I'm sure you were thinking, well, this might be your fate.
You start thinking that, but then in the beginning you start thinking that. When we first got there, we were first in a clandestine house for 3 days. And then transferred, blindfolded and transferred to prison. And, of course, we were petrified. We thought, oh, no, now we're in prison. We were hoping we'd get out in a few days. Now we're in prison. We knew we were going to be there a while. And I remember Alan saying to me, you know, this is a bad sign. If we start hearing people being tortured, that'll be worse, because why would they put us here and let us hear that if they're planning on letting us go? And, of course, it was only a matter of hours when it began. After a few days, though, we realized that they couldn't touch us, that the guards were under orders not to touch us in any way. And I tried to be positive. I was hoping that Saddam would be pragmatic about it and see it, you know, to be in his interest to try to, you know, for good PR, to release an American and a French reporter. And at that point, I started not, you know, I was able to handle it better personally, and I really was just feeling terrible for the people in the Iraqi prison, Iraqis as well as I believe some Sudanese and maybe some Egyptians. Those people, as far as I know, are still there. And certainly, you know, for those people, it was a terrible sense of helplessness. There's nothing one can do in prison. There's no appealing to a lawyer. There's no appealing to the International Committee of the Red Cross. There's nothing. The Iraqi guards and the Iraqi authorities own you. And they can do anything they want to you, physically, mentally, any time they wish. The abuse that we saw of other prisoners was really just horrifying.
Journalist Frank Smyth is my guest. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Frank Smyth. He was held prisoner for more than 2 weeks by Iraqi soldiers. There are a lot of journalists in the United States who were working for your release. And I know at least one of those people was concerned. I mean, they were, among other things, going to try to convince the Pentagon to work on your behalf. And I know that at least one journalist was concerned that United States officials might be resistant to working on your behalf because in some of your reporting you'd been critical of the CIA. You had been avoiding the military censorship system during the war. Were you concerned about that?
My main concern in prison was as a freelance reporter, you're never sure who's going to go to bat for you and who's going to back you up. Since my credentials were CBS, I had a video 8 camera that I was shooting for the CBS Evening News. I presented myself, the Iraqis may not have heard the Village Voice, as a CBS reporter. Now, the problem that I was afraid of is when Bob Simon, a CBS staff television correspondent, was in prison, there was a tremendous amount of effort done by CBS on his behalf. And my fear was if CBS didn't do something similar for me, then the Iraqis would say, see, they worked hard for Bob Simon, they aren't doing much for Smythe, therefore he must be a spy. Realizing that the Iraqis are probably not going to be able to distinguish quite, would be familiar with the concept of a staff correspondent as opposed to a freelance reporter and a stringer. In fact, CBS did go to bat for me, especially CBS Radio, which I've been with for over three years, and as well as the Committee to Protect Journalists and others.
Now, you think that Saddam Hussein was directly responsible for your release. What makes you say that? What information do you have? And was he pressured to release you? I mean, what did he know? Why did he release you? What can you tell us?
Well, short after we were captured and we were held in this clandestine house, one of our handlers, let's say, a liaison for military intelligence, told us, we now have information. The president is aware of your situation and he is evaluating your case. It was, of course, the next day we went to prison. And then it was 18 days later that guards came to our cell and said, come on, you're going home. It was 11 o'clock at night. There were two gentlemen who presented themselves as being from the Ministry of Information, and they said, you're leaving. As we were driving out of the prison, the guards said, we want you to know that the decision to release Mr. Alan and Mr. Frank came personally from President Saddam. So that it's on that basis that we believe he made the decision personally. Also, knowing the way Iraq works, the way the Iraqi military works, a decision of that nature could not, I don't think, possibly be made by anyone else except Saddam Hussein. It's a very much a top-heavy system. It's a one-man show, at least at the top.
What do you think his motivation was?
I think his motivation was that he's really reaching out to the West. He's in a very difficult situation economically. His country was destroyed as a result of the Gulf War. He's an extremely pragmatic player. He wants to stay in power, but at the same time, he's extraordinarily weak. And it was clear after we got out that he's really trying to reach out to the press, trying to develop as good a relationship with the press as he could. I also believe, however, had he known that we had witnessed at least heard, if not, though we did not see, but at least had witnessed in an audio sense the execution of Gad Gross, who was a German photographer, I do not think, or at least certainly he would have taken that into account before he let us go. But during our interrogations, military intelligence was much more interested in what we knew about the Kurds and how we had gotten into Iraq, and in trying to prove we were spies, than in really questioning us too thoroughly on what had happened to Gad Gross.
Have the Iraqis admitted to the murder of Gad Gross? Has his body been released?
To the best of my knowledge, the Iraqis have never said anything about Gad Gross. In fact, their actions and words seem to indicate that their position is that he never existed. This, of course, is not true, and the Iraqis know that because they had his camera bag and his passport in their possession. It moved with us between all the military intelligence handlers, all the interrogators, up until we were transferred to prison. It was in the car with us when we were taken to prison. That's the last we saw of it. So certainly they know he exists. He existed. They know he was there. They have his camera bag. They have his passport. The family has now made an appeal to have the body retrieved. And to the best of my knowledge, the Iraqis have neither confirmed nor denied having any knowledge of the case.
As one of the last people to see the journalist Gad Gross, and as one of the two people who heard his murder, I wonder what responsibility you feel to his family now. Have you visited with them or called them or anything?
Yes, the whole time I was probably the most difficult thing of this whole ordeal was was that fact. The whole time I was in prison, I was thinking about how I would approach the family and his photo agent, who was also a friend of his. There were several memorial services which I attended, and there will be another one, I believe, June 4th at Photographers Association in New York. But I've actually become very close to the family since we were released.
Frank Smyth, one last question. Would you ever cover an insurgency again?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the problem is my family. I mean, it's very difficult having been missing. They went through a terrible ordeal. But at the same time, you know, I think we did what we did for the right reasons. We were there to ascertain the situation and to try to get the truth and to try not only to document what was happening in Iraq, but to try to document and portray why the Kurds were rebelling and what was the nature of the Kurdish struggle. And you can't do that from a hotel room. You have to do that from the field. And I think that's just the nature of the business.
Frank Smyth, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Frank Smyth recently wrote about his capture and release in The Village Voice. This is Fresh Air.